Welcome to Iowa Public Radio's Iowa Art Showcase, our monthly performing arts program devoted to Iowa's not-for-profit arts and cultural organizations. I'm Jacqueline Hallblum. Today's show presents highlights for December and January. We'll see how the Christmas carol, Deck the Halls, takes on a new meaning. We'll anticipate the presentation of an amazing one-man show called Soldier Songs, being presented by the Des Moines Metro Opera in late January. We'll revel in the glorious sounds of the Canadian Brass during their Whirlwind Iowa appearances. And we'll discover what remarkable singers are heading to Iowa to perform in the Cedar Rapids Opera Theater's double billing next month as they usher in their 19th season. That's all ahead on Iowa Public Radio's Iowa Art Showcase. Thanks for joining us.
We've never done these two pieces, Cavalleria Rusticana and Pagliacci. And my first introduction to the pieces happened at the University of Iowa about 25 years ago. And it was a production of Beaumont Glass. And I remember vividly seeing the two pieces. I had friends singing in the production. I was a student there myself. And I can recall, even now, the beautiful main drape there at the old Hampshire. It had white and red in it. And I'm bringing this up because at the beginning of Pagliacci, it begins with the great prologue, which is typically done downstage or in front of that main rag. So I have not only a memory of the piece because of the music, but also that great visual image of the prologue.
You know, I have a lot of understanding because I sang and danced and acted. I know what it is to be on the stage. So I know when I ask a performer to lay on their back when they're singing a high note, I know what I'm asking. And I know if it's plausible or just plain cruel.
Daniel Kleinknecht, founding artistic director and conductor of the Cedar Rapids Opera Theater, and guest stage director Candace Evans. Internationally known director and choreographer Candace Evans has produced over 80 operas, musicals, plays, and ballets. Originally from the Midwest, she makes her Iowa directing debut from her home base in Texas. Candace fills us in on the two operas that the Cedar Rapids Opera Theater is presenting.
They both were written during a time in opera history where realism came to the fore. And by that, I mean the common man, rather than about nobility or people of means or royalty. The first piece is Cavalleria Rusticana, and it is set in southern Italy on an Easter Sunday morning. The second piece is Pagliacci, and everyone has heard of that because it's Pagliacci the Clown, and if anyone was raised during the No More Rice Krispies era, you know the main aria. The two pieces deal with love, loss, passion, jealousy, and what happens when you stir all those up and sing about them.
Candace decided to rearrange the opera segments, starting with the famous prologue to Pagliacci, and Daniel Kleinknecht agreed. Candace decided to rearrange the opera segments, starting with the famous prologue to Pagliacci, and Daniel Kleinknecht agreed.
When I was asked to do the directing of these pieces, the set had been designed, and it is an Italian village square. The usual look, if you were to Google image Italian village, that's what you would see. And because of that, I thought hard about the fact that I wanted them to be in the same town. Because of the timelessness of those pieces and the timelessness of Italian villages, I thought, let's just let it be in the same place. So the first one, as I said, is written to be performed as Easter Sunday morning. The second one, I determined I wanted to be in the fall, in the same village, with basically the same people. To make that more coherent, the prologue begins Pagliacci. The prologue basically says, ladies and gentlemen, the author of this piece is saying to you, these are recognizable people. These are recognizable emotions. We are not just actors. These are real and true emotions, and we are feeling them to the best of our ability so that you can too. So I'm placing that prologue at the beginning of the evening because it then speaks to both of the operas, because they both deal with very heartfelt, challenging situations between men and women, between faith, between hope and dreams, trying for one thing and then being handed another. And we're setting it in the 40s. And that was important to me because it's a time of sort of relief from the stress of the wars, a hopefulness, but there is also a downtroddenness of having endured something. So I feel that that opens people to a psychological neediness that these stories address.
And it makes great sense because really the prologue of Pagliacci could be done before any piece in a way, because Tonio is coming out of character. He's coming downstage and not being part of his opera persona, but he's saying, you might see us here on stage as actors and actresses in makeup and costume, and you can see us imitating life, but we are real human beings and we are just portraying true life. So it gives us just an interesting look inside of art, inside of the pieces.
Candace and Daniel talk about Cavalleria Rusticana by Leon Cavallo.
It's a very different feeling. It's also very realistic. It's based in humanistic terms. You begin with Easter morning, and the village is getting ready for their day, for the festival of Easter. It is a classic Italian Catholic town, and so as a feast day, all else is set apart, which is not so different from now for Christians and an Easter Sunday, or the Jewish people in a Passover, or whatever. It's a very high holy day. The village square is anticipating everyone's arrival to go to Mass. The women of the village are getting things ready at a community table for people to have a little celebration after the service. And a young woman arrives in search of the man that she loves. And she can't find him. She does indeed find his mother and inquires as to where he might be. And she says, I don't know. He went off to buy wine in the neighboring village. And she says, no, I don't think so. I saw him here in the village earlier this morning. So suspicions begin to be aroused as to what he told his mother. What is he doing? He has recently come back from being a soldier in the war and has been a lover of this young woman. But he had a relationship prior to that. And the young lady who promised to wait for him to come back didn't. And so you have a little love mess going on of everyone loving or wanting the wrong person that they can or cannot have. And it's an interesting juxtaposition because it's a day of high faith commitment. And this young woman feels that because she has sinned, she is not married to this man. She feels she cannot go in to church and begs with him to love her again and make their relationship legitimate. And his mother is Mama Lucia. And basically, I think he's very, very aware that she is an outcast at this point in time. He is leaving her, not even at the altar. It is never said in the piece that she tells him that she's expecting a baby. That is something that is up to the staging director. But if he is aware of that, then he knows that this woman is carrying the grandchild. And there's also sort of a loophole, I guess you could say, in that if he is dead, then she's more like a widow than a sinner. Even though they are not legally married, they were promised to each other, and everyone in the village understands that. What they know is that they loved each other, and then he jilted her. So it is a really poignant moment, and I guess probably the closest he comes to being fully likable in the piece, because he's really not. And so to begin with, he loved Lola, and they were promised to each other, and it was all great, swell, fine, love you, honey, I'll be back as soon as the war is over. And he comes back, and whoops, Lola has said, you know, I just didn't really think you were going to come back, so I married this other guy, and he's really rich, and it's all good. I have a great dress, and I've got the nicest house in town. So if somebody is really the villain of the piece, I think it would be Lola. What he needed to do was come back and stay with Santuzza and not be tempted by Lola, but these things happen.
And of course, in between these great dramatic happenings, we have spectacular choruses, wonderful duets, and some extraordinary music, exciting music. And of course, the beautiful intermezzo, orchestral only part in the middle of that piece, which is a piece that's often extracted from the score and played by orchestras alone.
Candace and Daniel go on to explain Pagliacci.
Pagliacci is the name of the clown within the show within a show. Basically, what you're dealing with is a troupe of players who come through the villages and enact plays and do clowning and tricks and entertainment for the people who are there. The man who portrays the clown is married to a young woman who we find out later he sort of found as an orphan along the road, a hard luck gal that he fell in love with and helped along in life, and now she's the star of the show. She's grateful, of course, but it might not have been the life that she chose. It was the life that was dealt her, and their relationship is very flawed. The play within a play deals also with a flawed relationship, with fidelity, with tricks. But what happens is this parallel world that the man and woman have to portray these characters who are joking and laughing about a flawed relationship when in truth that is exactly what they are enduring or trying to endure.
And as you get into the second act of this, you come to realize that the main character can't separate the two any longer.
No, his suspicions are aroused and things are all kind of coming together at once. And there's a wonderful aria where he's putting on his makeup and basically saying, I have to go out there and pretend that I don't care about this. So it's kind of an inside out of the prologue that I just spoke of. He's so very, very much feeling it as an actor.
And by the way, interesting to me is it's Pagliacci, not Pagliaccio. He's saying clowns, not clown the singular. And to me, that means he's trying to speak about humanity and how we all are, in a way, living lives of clowns. So we have Tonio coming out for the curtain with the prologue saying that we're actors, but we are human. And we have tears and we are true people. Then we have these, again, spectacular choruses. The children's chorus, the main adult chorus comes out and they set the stage. And then we have Canio, the tenor, coming out and saying, well, you know what? If I saw my wife having an affair on stage, it would be one thing. But if I saw her with another man or having eyes for another man in real life, there would be trouble. So his wife, Nedda, has one of the most beautiful arias in the 19th century opera, Stridono Lassù, where she sings about the beauty of the birds and the freedom of the birds and how they soar and swoop.
Candace Evans and Daniel Klein connect. Daniel compliments Candace's musical insight.
She had an idea that she presented to me that I thought was pretty interesting, and that was that the choruses are like the river, the constant. They are the part that flows through actually both pieces. And they're stable in a way. They continue the emotion. So it's going to be really interesting working with her. She recently did a production at Indiana University. She works a lot, and it'll be our pleasure to have her here in Cedar Rapids.
Tell us about some of the magnificent singers you have that will be performing.
Oh, every year I feel so fortunate. My job is so wonderful, getting to hear great singers in auditions and then getting to hire them. The cast is really special. Actually, we have three Iowa mezzos in this cast. Catherine Goldner, Teresa Buchholz, and Gennara Kellerman. Two of them live in New York, and Catherine lives in Austria. We're bringing them back, and they're going to be fantastic. We have a wonderful tenor. His name is Tao Pupua, and he comes to us from New York. And Tao has had an interesting life. He was a Cleveland Brown for several years before turning tenor. So he's going to be joining us. Christopher Clayton, baritone. Daniel Schofield is another of our baritones. And our soprano, Suzanne Vinnick, is also a really interesting person. I think she's also a designer of costumes. So she's going to be an interesting person to have in the cast as well. And Chris Carr, he had been one of our young artists. Now he's had a splendid career. His career is opening up as a tenor. He's going to be singing our Beppe in Pagliacci. People might remember him this summer. He was in Falstaff at Des Moines, and I think Galileo Galilei, a young man with management now. He's really going to have a great career. So we're looking forward to having him on the main stage this year as Beppe. And each of them is so different in their unique people. And they were all my first choices in casting. And I feel also so fortunate that I auditioned 125 young artists this last month. And we've hired our young artists who will cover each of these roles and then be in the chorus. And man, these young artists are spectacular too. I'm so thrilled to have this group of people together. They're going to be magnificent, this cast.
The Cedar Rapids Opera Theater's artistic director and conductor Daniel Kleinknecht, along with guest director Candace Evans. All of the singers in the CROT's January double bill production of Cavalleria Rusticana and I Pagliacci are amazing. The Cedar Rapids Opera Theater will present their double bill on Friday, January 13th at 7:30 p.m. and again on Sunday, January 15th at 2 p.m. at the Paramount Theater in Cedar Rapids. Other CROT events include a free winter concert with the singers at Temple Judah on Monday, January 2nd. On Monday, January 9th, the CROT will host their Zitzprobe Social at CR's Opus Concert Cafe. And at noon on Tuesday, January 10th, CROT singers will perform short selections in Iowa Public Radio Studio 1 on the UNI campus in Cedar Falls. The CROT young artists are also presenting performances of the operatic setting of Pinocchio on Saturday, January 7th in the CR Public Library and again on Tuesday, January 10th at the Coralville Center for the Performing Arts. For more details about other opera-related events and to get tickets for all performances, please see their website at cr-opera.org. Just ahead, we'll meet up with baritone Michael Mays and stage director Christine McIntyre as they focus on a new contemporary one-man opera by David T. Little called Soldier Songs. The powerful work, starring a gripping performance by Michael Mays, is being presented next month as part of the Des Moines Metro Opera's Second Stages series. We'll hear from one of the musicians of Canadian Brass about the globally celebrated ensemble. And we'll explore Iowa's own version of Downton Abbey as they roll out the red carpet and lots of midwinter cheer for the holidays. You're listening to Iowa Public Radio's Iowa Art Showcase.
The fantastic thing about Bruce Moore is it really is a unique place here in Iowa. There's no place like this in the whole United States, a place where you have the power of the history combined with the engagement of the community. It's that synergy that really makes a place like Bruce Moore special and irreplaceable.
Bruce Moore Mansion's Deputy Director Brent Lobello. Bruce Moore, a 19th-century mansion majestically set on a 26-acre estate in Cedar Rapids, really decorates for the holidays. In addition to revving up their 1929 Skinner pipe organ for Thursday night lineup and weekend tours, they also daily throw out the welcome mat for tours through December 31st, closing only on Christmas Eve Day and Christmas Day. During its long history, three different families lived in the Queen Anne Mansion before Margaret Hall bequeathed her family estate to the National Trust for the Historic Preservation in 1981. Mrs. Hall's generosity has enriched Iowa and Iowans ever since. The mansion, spectacular to see at any time of the year, is adorned from top to bottom with incredible decorations for the holidays. Included in the mix is the mansion's recently conserved and now open for viewing sleeping porch, which was designed and built by none other than Iowa's own Grant Wood.
It's fantastic. Right now, for our holidays, that includes about, I think it's 16 trees spaced out throughout the mansion. They are decorated in more of a classic decoration, not what the Douglases necessarily would have had back in the 20s, but something that we as a 21st century audience can sort of look at and gravitate towards. On the weekends and during that Thursday night lineup tours, we do play the 1929 Skinner organ, so you actually do, for the only time throughout the year, you get to hear the organ being played in the mansion, so it's quite a treat. We also have different outside decorations as well. Our building and grounds team right now is actually right in the midst of putting up Christmas balls that light up throughout the property, throughout all of our roadways. We're hanging wreaths. It's going to be something.
Tell us what folks can enjoy besides these trees when they see the mansion.
We've actually opened up a new exhibit on Grant Wood and his relationship with the Cedar Rapids community and the Douglases. It's a fantastic exhibit, and it's a little bit different, too, from your typical historic house experience. As you're coming into the room, we have a touchscreen monitor. You also have the ability to touch an artist's recreation of the Grant Wood sleeping porch, which is a 3D mosaic, almost, that he created. You also, for the first time since 1981, have the ability to walk out onto the porch. Before, you could sort of look over a velvet rope, but now we've put a viewing deck out there so the public actually has the chance to go into that same space that Grant Wood was at when he created the sleeping porch and decorated it. And one of the other very cool parts of the sleeping porch exhibit is that we had a 3D print made, and it's adhered to the viewing deck. So while you're actually out on that viewing deck in that space looking at the sleeping porch that Grant Wood created, you can also touch within the millimeter of detail, you can touch something that is exactly like what you're seeing. So while seeing it and also feeling it, it's a sensory extravaganza.
Tell us about the circumstances in Grant Wood's life when he was hired to do this porch and how the family found out about him.
Where Grant Wood was in 1925 was he was not the Grant Wood that we typically think of today. Typically, we think of Grant Wood as the guy that created American Gothic. This is about 6 years before that. So he is a working artist here in Cedar Rapids, trying to make a buck wherever he can. So he is creating the Grant Wood porch. He's also creating interiors for other families in town. He's doing different things like ironwork, necklaces. He's not just that one painter that we typically think of him as, or even as an American regionalist and driving that style. He hasn't yet defined that or found that for himself. So this is a sort of a pivotal time for him before he has really become that iconic Grant Wood.
And it's kind of unusual in the fact that Irene Douglas could have gone to New York or Paris or someplace and hired somebody, but no, she hired Grant Wood.
It's fantastic that she was a great advocate for the local art scene. She was hiring people like Grant Wood, Marvin Cohn, others from the community. She could have just as easily gone to Chicago, New York, Minneapolis, one of the bigger hotbeds for arts at the time, but she wanted to cultivate that scene here. And that's one of the things that I think is very unique about the Douglas family, is that they could have done a lot of things, but they really stuck to their Iowa roots and really tried to bring everybody up with them and develop those artists, those different folks in the community here.
This is the 125th anniversary of Grant Wood's birth. So describe this porch and how Grant Wood designed it.
The sleeping porch was originally open air. And what Grant Wood did is he put a layer of plaster over top of the brick that is part of Bruce Moore. And he put curved vines and decorated in all sorts of different animals that you could have probably seen on Bruce Moore's estate on the 26 acres. So there's a deer that he has put in there. There are plenty of birds, a squirrel, a snail. There's all sorts of these different things that he's put on the sleeping porch. And the whole idea, or at least the theory, is that he was bringing the outside inside so that when the Douglas girls could go to sleep out there, they were outside in the nature, but they were also in Bruce Moore on their estate in this interior exterior space, but living in with the nature.
And it's kind of whimsical the way it's put together.
Grant Wood has a fantastic flavor for how to craft and put all of these different elements in. And that's one of the things that you do see with this piece is you see that imagination and sort of that engineering eye, that artistic eye and idea that he is able to put all of this together into something that's both visually exciting, but also takes you out into more of a magical sense of what that art really was.
Now, you also, in January, are going to be doing some special events, and you're going to be using theater as well as some very special things.
In January, we actually have the Modern Salon, which utilizes the mansion as well. We have a great partnership with SBT Theater, and SBT performs. It's a variety show almost with skits, music, humor, laughter. I think I might have cried the last time around. But you really get to feel of this is how the Douglases would have used their home for entertaining. You're in that historic structure, and you're using it in a modern way, the same way that they did in the 20s, in the teens. So it's a really pretty cool usage of the space, the same way they did.
So how can folks get more information and find out more details about these holiday walks and tours and more about this salon in January?
The easiest route to go is to go to brucemoore.org. We have a tab on there for events, and you can sort of learn more about the events that we do year-round, but more specifically, you can learn about the events that we are doing for the holidays as well as Modern Salon.
Brent Lobello, Bruce Moore Mansion's Deputy Director. In addition to their tours and modern salons, Bruce Moore hosts unique cultural events and special exhibits throughout the year. Bruce Moore, along with all the other museums and art centers across the state, also has a fine gift shop. Other exhibits across Iowa include the National Czech and Slovak Museum, presenting a multimedia exhibit featuring outfits and props from the 1984 film Amadeus, the Des Moines Art Center showing Vivian Meyer through a critical lens, the Cedar Rapids Museum of Art exhibiting Grant Wood from farm boy to American icon, the Dubuque Museum of Art presenting works by Priscilla Steele, Thomas Jackson, and Zane York, the McNider showing works of Laurie Brewer Stewart and Area Show 45, the WCF Symphony performing a new Nutcracker showcasing the music of Ellington and over 20 new works by Gary Kelly, and the Figge displaying Rose Franson's Portrait of Makokita, Lazansky's Kaddish, Rembrandt and the Jews, and Giving the Devil His Due, The Art of Gary Kelly. Just ahead, we'll get the inside scoop on the Kings of Brass holiday concert tour in Iowa. And we'll hear about David T. Little's powerful opera, Soldier Songs, being presented at Camp Dodge by the Des Moines Metro Opera later next month. This is the Iowa Art Showcase on Iowa Public Radio.
sun.
Because the piece deals with such modern ideas of media culture and Hollywood and all of that, it kind of asks you to have a video element that goes with it. So we're designing really interesting video projections, and there are TV screens that are built into the scenery. I think this will be a really interesting experience of taking art to a place that doesn't necessarily usually have art and performance in this way. I think this will be the first time the piece has ever been done on an active military base, and I'm really thrilled to be able to take it right to the audience that helped create it and to tell really honestly and without any prejudice the stories of these vets and these soldiers that have done so much for us. I've always heard that vets have a really strong reaction when they see this piece because even though they may not personally have chosen to tell their own stories, they recognize that we are trying very hard to listen to them and to do what they have not been able to do, which is to speak about their experience in some way and to let people know. And I think that that's really important for all of us. We all have benefited from the sacrifices that they've made, and now we need to hear their story. And Michael is a really visceral performer, and you want somebody to do this who is going to be willing to go to a very emotionally charged and often very dark place, not like your average opera singer. And he's always willing to do whatever it takes to tell the story to its best advantage.
I think what I want to do more than anything is the same thing I want to do with every piece I do. I believe it's the duty of a performer to increase empathy, to teach us how to see the world through another person's eyes. And I think that it's important that we do shows about this particular disease, PTSD, and we get insight into what these guys go through, because I think a lot of times we don't know. And it's impossible to read a book about it, and it's impossible to be clinical about it because it is such an emotional thing. It's hard to explain to somebody scientifically what happens. But the great thing about opera and music and theater is that it transcends those things. You can actually, without understanding the intricacies and every tiny detail of that person's life or a particular situation or disease or whatever, you're able to feel what it's like to be them without having to understand everything that there is about them.
The Des Moines Metro Opera's stage director, Christine McIntyre, and baritone Michael Mays. The Des Moines Metro Opera, as part of their Second Stages series, will present David T. Little's imaginative and thought-provoking work, Soldier Songs, in January at the Freedom Center at Camp Dodge. The DMMO's Second Stages series focuses on new pieces and performing them out in the community in a location that reflects what the work is about. Christine fills in some background on David T. Little and his work, Soldier Songs.
He was interested in issues surrounding soldiering in America, what it means to become a soldier in America, how we make soldiers. And he realized that he had several close friends that had been to Iraq and Afghanistan, and that there were many members of his own family, in fact, that had experiences of different wars. And the one commonality between all of these soldiers that he knew is that they had never spoken of their experiences. He said he has uncles who served in Vietnam who never spoke of it again. And so he was curious to know if he could get them to speak to him. He didn't know where the piece was going to go as a result of that. He said he didn't really have an agenda. He just wanted to hear what they had to say. So he began interviewing people and found that his grandfather and his uncles and his friends were all, strangely but fortunately, very willing to talk to him. So the piece is based on these interviews. And he found that there was a lot that all of these soldiers, even though the wars were different, there were some commonalities of experience. One of the big ones, as I said, is that they didn't speak of their experiences once they came home. But the biggest one was something that has been called the one-way door of combat, this idea that you go and you serve and you experience combat, and it's a door that you pass through and you never fully come back from that experience, that it's something that changes you utterly, that you come back from war a different person. And of course, this is an essential human experience that we've been talking about in various ways in the arts since the Odyssey, since Homer's time. You know, it's one of the essential human experiences. So from these interviews, David wrote a series of songs, and eventually found a structure to it that tracks through the experience of war and soldiering from childhood through the young soldier through to the elder who has come home from war and now needs to somehow classify and deal with that experience. And the piece asks us to reflect on the way that the ideas of war and heroes are kind of packaged by the media and by American culture to create these sorts of ideals of what it means to be an American soldier. That we market guns to children and that we create this idea of G.I. Joe that is probably really unrealistic in terms of the actual experience of going and fighting a war. And the ways in which Hollywood participates in this, that we make these war films that purport to know what it is to go and to fight in a war and then to come back. And that there's this disconnect between watching a war movie or a Ken Burns documentary or whatever and the actual real experience of being in combat. And he said in talking to his friends specifically that had been in Iraq and Afghanistan, one of them had been in a car bomb attack. And he said that it was so different from all the Hollywood things that he'd ever seen. And in fact, there's a song that deals very specifically with this in Soldier Song called Hollywood Ending, where suddenly the young soldier starts yelling, cut, cut, why won't anyone yell cut? Because, of course, the experience is so different and so horrifying compared to what he had been told it would be.
So tell us about some of the things that David Little brings in to this production that makes it so unusual.
There is a different set of instruments than we usually hear in opera. David Little has a background in rock music as well as classical music, so this opera is, I would say, rockier than your average opera. It's also got a lot of sound effects that are part of it, and in fact the entire piece is amplified, both the singer and the orchestra, and then there are all of these various kinds of sound effects and different sorts of sounds that you might hear in a more traditional piece. But as a result, it feels much more modern and much more like the landscape of sounds that we're used to hearing. So that it has some sort of filmic elements, it has some rock elements, and also some moments of real introspection and really sort of quiet, beautiful singing. And it's very interesting. So it's a piece that kind of pushes the boundaries of what traditional opera might be. And as a result, for us, it's really intriguing and quite a lot of fun. And this is a great way of experiencing something that doesn't feel like what you think opera is going to be like. This will be a great piece of music theater, and it will engage you in a way that many operas are unable to, because it's really modern, because it's really raw, because it will be about things that you already know about. If you're an opera goer and you're scared of this because this sounds like it's too modern or too out there or it won't be beautiful, trust me when I say to you that this will be a beautifully emotional and moving experience, and that this is what we think the art form can be at its best in 2016. And so I urge you to come and experience what the future looks like.
The Des Moines Metro Opera stage director, Christine McIntyre, talking about David T. Little's cutting-edge soldier songs that she will direct as part of the DMMO's Second Stages series next month. Christine and baritone Michael Mays are making scenery and video projections that will be featured in their new DMMO production. Michael has a history with the Des Moines Metro Opera. In 2010, he sang the role of Count Almaviva in the DMMO's production of Mozart's The Marriage of Figaro. The next summer, he performed as the painter Marcello in the company's La Boheme presentation. In 2012, he created the villainous title role of Don Giovanni in the DMMO's production of Mozart's masterpiece. Over Thanksgiving, Michael auditioned for a role at the Met and is doing another show called From Opera to Opry, Liquor, Love, and the Lord, which compares the commonality between opera and country music. Michael is drawn to and excels in thorny roles.
These tough, sort of gritty roles that are often in what I like to call operas with a conscience. These operas that take on sort of the epic problems of our society and our culture, our situations. And these epic problems, I think, are really best addressed with an epic art form like opera, which is just epic in scale. And really, I think it's the only way you can really get to the heart of some of these issues. And that's why I find that it's a really effective format when you're dealing with things like PTSD or the death penalty or earlier instances of issues of slavery in our country. These subjects, you know, they're often very polarizing and people have very definite opinions on them. However, the great thing about music is that it's sort of universal and it speaks to that sort of universal thing in itself. So for me, I feel like I've been very fortunate that I've been able to use my art in a way that I feel like benefits people in the audience rather than just entertains them.
Michael has a particular affinity for the American composer Jake Hagee's music. Hagee has been influential in promoting his career, and Michael has made a name for himself by creating several Hagee signature opera roles.
A lot of people find Jake's music to be difficult to learn, but for me, it's not difficult to learn because I just sort of get his language. And Jake never takes on a subject that is not close to my heart, and everything that I've done with him has had some sort of personal meaning in my own life. It's been one of the most fulfilling artistic relationships I've ever had. And before I did Dead Man Walking, I had a decent career, but it's hard to break through the noise. And I didn't have what people think you do. You know, you go to school, and then you get a young artist program, and then, you know, you start working at the big houses, and then you become famous. And that works out for some folks, and for me, it did work out that way, and sort of came up the hard way. I call it working on the opera chitlin' circuit. I took every single job at every small regional opera company that there was, and I learned by doing. I learned while I earned, and I didn't have a whole lot of training programs, things like that. I just sort of learned kind of coming up the hard way, and I'm not so married to convention and things like that for that reason, because I didn't come up a conventional way. I'm not a conventional opera singer, and when it comes to doing art and work that's unconventional, it seems to fit very well.
Tell us about David T. Little's Soldier Songs.
It's a different kind of opera. It's not your mama's opera. And he has the kind of music, I think, that speaks to a whole new generation of opera audiences. When you go see a piece by David Little, you're not going to get a traditional opera experience. Number one, his subject matter is never safe. It's always dangerous. And the musical choices he makes and the styles that he blends, it's extremely daring. And I think, especially with a piece like Soldier Songs that deals with the issues of this cycle of perpetual war and the real effect that the war has on these individual soldiers, we sort of look at the way war affects society. We don't always look at how it affects soldiers. His style of music and the way he sets text and everything really speaks well to that particular type of issue. And it runs the gamut from lyric to expressionistic to everything. Anytime you go to a little show, it's going to be a wild ride. And the piece takes you through the life of a soldier, through his childhood, through being raised in a society where the G.I. Joe phenomenon, the greatest American hero, things like this, where as a child, you're given toy soldiers and toy guns and told to emulate war. It sort of trains you up to be a soldier. Then we move into an area of his life where he's playing a lot of video games, and video games are a great training for the drone program and things like this. And as he progresses through his life from a little kid that's fascinated with war and sort of romanticized the entire concept of war, as he gets closer and closer to actually becoming a soldier and actually being drafted and then going to war and then experiencing the horror of war and how it affects him, and then moving into old age as an old soldier whose son then is killed in a subsequent war, and his act of revenge is to set the car of the two Marines who come to deliver the letter about how thankful the country is for his sacrifice of his son. While they're at the front door, he runs around and lights their car on fire, sort of sends a message that way. And Christine and I, the director, are still trying to find the soul of this piece. And this piece really is about an individual soldier's experience from childhood into old age. And what is it like for these guys to have to deal with this stress? And now we have to start talking about and telling the stories of the men who come back and aren't okay. So that's what I think the power of what these kind of pieces are about. It's how we can tell the stories that aren't so comfortable. We're not so comfortable talking about these stories, but I think that's what our duty is if we're going to do right by these guys.
For you as a performer and as a singer, how do you go through this journey?
I always say we're so lucky because we get to do things on stage that if we did them out on the street, we'd get arrested for them. So for me, it's an honor, really, and a privilege. And what I want them to take away from it is a kind of an understanding of the emotional landscape of men and women who come back in the theater of war and have to deal with the atrocities and the horror that they've seen. And then somehow are supposed to be plugged back into our society where they go to Walmart and Sam's Club and Wendy's and things like that and encounter a lot of the same noises and things and impulses that they encountered in the theater of war, but they don't have a dangerous element, you know. Just like to say, I'm actually super proud of my association with Des Moines Metro Opera. Robert Larson gave me a role back when I couldn't get arrested in opera, you know, and he gave me a lead right off the bat. And that did a lot for me. You know, it gave me a lot of confidence, for one, but it allowed me to be seen by some other people and led to other work. And through the course of my career, I'm fortunate because I landed in this career in a time when there was a real renaissance of new American works. And this is what opera should be, and I think will be in the future. We will always have Bohème. We will always have Carmen, because those pieces will endure for hundreds of years. They'll last. But these kinds of pieces are the kinds of pieces that reach out across generations and speak to people that probably didn't have a typical experience in opera house before. They're able to come in and see something that's more like the kinds of media that they're able to digest. And new opera composers in America today are taking on these subjects. And actually, you know, there's so many companies are supporting these composers. And Des Moines, to their credit, was one of the first companies that was like, we're going to start doing new works. We're going to make this happen. This is part of our thing. And it's our duty now, as stewards of this great art form, to continue to develop and to make sure that it remains relevant and that it's something that remains a part of the cultural landscape of every society.
The Des Moines Metro Opera's baritone, Michael Mays, who will perform the role of the soldier. He was joined by stage director Christine McIntyre. They were talking about David T. Little's unique and commanding soldier songs that the DMMO will present as part of their second stages series. The DMMO's David Neely will conduct the production. The show will be performed in English with English supertitles. The Des Moines Metro Opera will be presenting soldier songs at the headquarters of the Iowa National Guard in Johnston in their Freedom Center at Camp Dodge. Photo IDs are required for admittance to the camp. Performances will be held at 7:30 on Friday and Saturday nights, January 27th and 28th, with a matinee performance on Sunday, January 29th at 2. For more details and tickets, please see DesMoinesMetroOpera.org. Don't go away, because in this case, all that glitters is gold. You're listening to Iowa Public Radio's Iowa Art Showcase.
It's a very rare thing when you get to work with people. I would say this about all the guys in the group now, that everybody is a very, you know, warm, kind individual who has very much the group in mind when working. And one of the greatest virtues of being a chamber musician is to say that you're constantly trying to make everybody around you sound better than they do. It's a very giving thing. But it doesn't always happen. Sometimes you get people that are very good players that might have their own agenda that's just not very fun to work with them. And that is not the case with the other members, because they're just such great musicians, such great human beings, and have so much to offer the group.
Bernard Scully, French horn player with the Canadian Brass. Tomorrow afternoon at the Gallagher Blue Dorn and next Friday night at Cheslow Auditorium, fortunate audience members will have the joyous opportunity to hear the globally acclaimed Canadian Brass in concert. The Canadian Brass were the first brass ensemble to serenade Carnegie Hall's main stage. They have put the art of brass quintet playing on the international map. Each of the five players can knock your socks off with their technical prowess, impressive musicianship, and their love of performing, accompanied by an endless sense of humor. Tubist Chuck Dollenbach was one of the original founding members. Trombonist Achilles Lier Makopoulos is originally from Greece. Trumpeters Christopher Coletti and Caleb Hudson are both virtuosos, drawing inspiration from each other. And Bernard Scully on horn studied at Northwestern and the University of Wisconsin-Madison. He played for the Canadian Brass, performed for several years as principal horn with the St. Paul Chamber Orchestra, and later took a teaching post at the University of Illinois in Champaign-Urbana. And for the last 3 years, he not only has been teaching at the University of Illinois, but also performing full-time with the Canadian Brass. The Canadian Brass have commissioned over 600 works and arrangements for brass quintet and sold well over 2 million recordings worldwide. Besides performing in every major concert hall around the globe, they have been viewed by hundreds of millions on television and YouTube. Canadian Brass horn player Bernard Scully fills us in on how the ensemble got its start.
The group has an amazing history. When I first started playing the French horn, my first recordings I would listen to, my first videos I would see, my first music I would use was all Canadian Brass music and recordings and videos. So this group had a huge impact on me, as it did many, many students of music in Canada and America and the world, especially that formative time when you're younger. And the group really had an interesting start. They all were from Hamilton. They were all in the Hamilton Symphony initially. Chuck Dellenbach and Gene Watts. Stuart Lawton, I think, was one of the first trumpet players. And the symphony was called the Hamilton Plan. It was a plan to bring chamber music and the orchestra's forces to a 60-mile radius around the town of Hamilton. And so the brass quintet in the symphony was the outreach group for the brass players. So they started to do all these young people's concerts under the banner of the Hamilton Symphony. And after about a year of doing this, the group had tremendous success. They became very popular. The brass quintet shows were really one of the highlights of this plan. And so the guys in the group, they basically said, well, you know, what would it be like if we just broke away and started doing our own thing, because we love it so much. We love this idea of the brass chamber ensemble, similar to the string quartet. But there had never been fully viable brass quintet in the history of music. String quartets had existed for many, many years, but brass musicians were pretty much relegated to playing in the orchestra or the military bands to make their living. So this is the first time a group branches out and does something totally different when you're brass chamber music, and they want to make a full living at it. They want to do it entirely onto its own. So they took a big risk to separate from the Hamilton Symphony. But within 7 years, the Canadian government was in a position to send a musical group to China. America had sent the Philadelphia Orchestra, and Canada was like, well, who should we send? And they said, well, there's this really amazing group out of Hamilton that's touring the world now. We think of them as one of our most wonderful representatives for musicians in Canada. And so they sent the Canadian Brass to China in 1977. And after that tour, it was like an explosion of popularity. And up until now, I mean, the group has just continued to grow and grow in popularity and has done over 130 recordings. They've played with every single major symphony in the United States and abroad, and the publishing and the books. It's really an extraordinary organization, and it's really an amazing honor for me to be a part of this organization. It has such a big influence on me personally and the world. You know, it's humbling for me to describe the history of the group and to think that I'm a part of it now.
Rumor has it that everybody in the Canadian Brass play on 24-karat gold-plated instruments. Is that true?
It is true. Sometimes you make an exception for some of the auxiliary trumpets, but basically all the primary instruments are gold-plated, and they're given to us by Conn Selmer Company, which is our amazing sponsoring company. And they tie into all the work they do with education, and they give us these instruments, and they gold-plate them for us.
And does the gold-plating help?
Well, one thing it does is it protects the instruments better than almost any other material. There's a reason why gold is so valuable. It's because it's so resistant to corrosion. A lot of the instruments made of brass, nickel, silver, these things, they're pretty good metals, but they corrode over time. So having gold plating over the instruments essentially allows them to be preserved almost indefinitely as long as you take care of the instrument.
So is it true that you guys still wear sneakers to your concerts?
We do. Yep. And that started many years ago. when the group was, you know, building its reputation, they were doing a little skit of the most popular ballet music, and they were doing it in their traditional concert shoes, apparently, and they just couldn't do it. They had to take their shoes off. Finally, they just said, let's just wear sneakers. And so they came on stage with these white sneakers, and the audience loved it, and so it stuck. And I think in many ways it ties into what we're trying to do. We're playing music at the highest level, and at the same time, we want the audience to know that we're having a lot of fun, too. I want the concert to be a very enjoyable combination of appreciating great music, but also really enjoying the experience, strong connection with the audience, good for, you know, all ages, all interest levels. I mean, if you like music at all, you're likely to like our concert. I think we have something to offer everybody. And so the shoes are just basically letting everybody know that we have a lot of fun with what we do.
Well, speaking of fun, tell us about this great holiday program. Tell us about what people will be hearing.
Well, there's something for everybody. I think that if you like holiday music, we're doing Christmas music. We do some Hanukkah music. We do just general favorite holiday fare, Bing Crosby-type things. We're doing a Charlie Brown music for the most beloved TV Christmas program ever. We had this, one of our great arrangers arranged. Probably my favorite piece in the program is the Charlie Brown Suite, which is featured on the recent Christmas album, Christmas Time Is Here, since Giraldi charts. So we'll start with some Renaissance music. We have some Baroque music, then lots of holiday music, Christmas music, even other types of things. I can't give it all away. It's something for everybody. The music ranges from quite serious classical to very, very fun. We have Glenn Miller on there, Christmas show. We have a great arrangement for doing that. So it's just going to be a super fun experience. You can take anybody to the concert. If you have some relatives that don't know much about music, we'd like to think that we have something to offer them. You don't have to be an expert in classical music to enjoy our concert. In all age groups, you know, bring the kids. And we love what we're doing. I love every concert I play. I love playing in front of an audience, sharing what I have to offer, giving back what I've spent my whole life doing. I think the other guys would say the same. We really, really enjoy performing and entertaining audiences. And we generally get the sense they like our concerts too. So it's a really, really wonderful thing to get these concerts.
Canadian Brass French horn performer Bernard Scully. The Canadian Brass are performing their holiday concert tomorrow afternoon at 4 at UNI's Gallagher Blue Dorn Performing Arts Center. They are also presenting their holiday concert for the Civic Music Series next Friday night, December 9th at 7:30 at Cheslow Auditorium in Des Moines. For more details and tickets, go to gbpac.com or civicmusic.org. For more info about the amazing Canadian Brass, see canadianbrass.com. Today's December and January Iowa Art Showcase broadcast is a production of Iowa Public Radio. Program thanks for this show goes to Candace Evans, Daniel Kleinconnect, Brett Lobello, Christine McIntyre, Michael Mays, and Bernard Scully. Production thanks goes to Iowa Public Radio's Tony Daner. Production assistance thanks goes to IPR's John Pemble and Phil Moss. Operation thanks goes to IPR's Jason Burns, Sean McLean, Nick Brinks, and music director Al Scherz. Program research was provided by Rachel Berenger and Nick Schumacher. For more information on Iowa Public Radio's programming schedule and Iowa Public Radio's Iowa Art Showcase, please visit our website at iowapublicradio.org. I'm Jacqueline Hallbloom. Happy Holidays and 2017. Thanks for listening.